This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face to face with business decisions, online at www.bgov.com, and of course on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We have so much to discuss this week as we take a trip overseas to visit a virus that may be headed to the U.S. this summer, bringing with it opportunity? What? Is it knocking? Do you want it? Well, BGov analyst Nick Riscasi will be here to give us the details a little bit later. We'll also give you an update on the economy, talking jobs, housing. We'll find out when senior economic analyst Dr. Neela Richardson joins us in a little while. But we're going to kick off the program with what's turning into a pattern of sorts. I've seen it develop over the past couple of weeks. As we continue to draw down our military forces, the need for stuff, and I'm doing the air quotes now, is kind of dwindling. So defense contractors are now looking for opportunities overseas. In this chapter, we'll bring you the tale of the international jet fighter sales. Here with more, BGov quantitative analyst Duncan Amos. How are you?
Good. Good. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I'm glad you could make it. And the underscore on the analysis that you've put together basically says it all. The subtitle says, as U.S. budgets tighten, growth opportunities emerge in Qatar, Colombia, Mexico, Algeria, and Argentina. At first glance, those countries kind of seem to be a random assembly of sorts, but there was a method behind picking those. Give us an idea of how you managed to
Absolutely.
Get that together.
So we started with the universe of all countries, and then we applied different filters so we could narrow it down. The first one, of course, was that would that be a country that we'd be willing to export arms to? We're not exactly going to be selling fighter jets to Cuba anytime soon.
Right.
So that eliminated a number of
Much
countries.
Much to their dismay.
I'm sure. The second was that they have to have either large enough defense expenditures or fast enough growing expenditures that they could actually afford this kind of really expensive piece of hardware. And the last one is that we scoured through these countries' fleets of aircraft and then could identify who has modern aircraft versus who has old aircraft that might be interested in either replacing or upgrading.
Okay. So we're going to go through the list of them in just a little while, but what kind of aircraft are we talking about? Obviously, the F-35 is one that's a prime piece of real estate, so to speak, to be flying around. But it's pretty costly now.
It's pretty costly, yeah. So in terms of the United States export market, we're looking at the F-18 Super Hornet, the F-16, and the F-15.
What about there was one that was discontinued, and I can't remember the name of it now.
It's the F-22 Raptor, which is our kind of really powerful fighter jet.
Right.
The problem is, not only is that not we're not buying any more of those, but that contains so much U.S. hardware that we're not even allowed to export it.
Really?
Yeah. So no one can get it besides us.
So, okay, so that leads me down to another path here. As we're considering sales of these, obviously they have to pony up the dollars and we need to continue to do research. And we're not actually stating in this that this is exactly who we're selling to.
Right.
This is an analysis that you've put together who are prime pickings for possible defense contractors. So let's take a look at Algeria. We look at them and go, you know, let's sell them X, Y, and Z. Are we putting anything in these things to say, let's say they all of a sudden turn into a rogue nation of sorts where we could flick a switch that says, okay, you can't use this against us?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Are we dumbing it down for them? Are we taking anything out that we want to keep
Absolutely.
For ourselves?
There's, in any kind of, you know, very sophisticated piece of equipment like this, there are things that we can keep for ourselves that are highly classified, maybe really advanced American technology. It really depends on, A, what country you're selling it to, and how much, B, how much they're willing to spend. So, you know, if you think about it, maybe you get a more advanced radar, maybe you don't get a more advanced radar.
Right.
But in terms of risk, you know, there's actually less risk sometimes in selling these countries U.S. hardware. Because if they're buying maybe an advanced Russian jet, well, that's it. They have it. We can't do anything about that. But if we sell them an F-16, well, they're really reliant on the United States for support and equipment and training for years to come. So, you know, if something really awful happened, there's only so long that they could maintain these aircraft without U.S. support.
I just thought of this question, and I realize it may be out of the scope of the analysis that you've put together, but reading about the new Russian helicopter, you mentioned helicopters, the Alligator, brand new helicopter, it's amazing. They say it flies like a fighter jet. Are there any instances where other countries have developed something and are now shopping those wares overseas?
Absolutely. So besides Russia, you also have the Eurofighter Typhoon, which is this advanced fighter jet that's built by a consortium of European countries. The French have a number of planes. The Rafale is really the big one. Mm-hmm. And Sweden even has one called the Gripen.
So are these our competition, so to speak,
they
in
are.
This space?
Absolutely.
Would you say that they have a product that's, you know, far superior or inferior cost-wise? Are we looking at about the same product?
I think cost is the big thing. Yeah. Really between the United States and the Russian jets is that while the American jets may be way more advanced in some technical capability, the Russian jets are much cheaper. So in the end, it's about cost.
All right, so let's dive into some of these countries. Algeria, significant weapons importer. They've got a lot. What could they potentially be looking at picking up, and over what time frame?
Well, Algeria is a little bit unique that they do actually have some modern aircraft. They have these Su-30s, which are these Russian fighter jets, pretty modern. But they also have a lot of older Russian, you know, MiGs and kind of these ground attack aircraft that they really might be looking to upgrade. You might think of maybe the F-18. This is like really our pinnacle currently that we export that really has not only this fighter capability but also this ground attack capability that they might be looking to replace some of their older, you know, Su 23s and 24s with.
What about Argentina as we continue through the A's here? By the way, we're speaking with Duncan Amos here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. His analysis is entitled International Jet Fighter Sales as U.S. Budgets Tighten, Growth Opportunities Emerge in Qatar, Colombia, Mexico, Algeria, and Argentina. And what in the world would Argentina be looking to pick up at this point? I realize they are an emerging defense nation, so to speak. So air defense systems of some sort?
Perhaps. So Argentina never really recovered their aircraft from the Falcon Thor back in the 80s.
Right.
And they went through a period of, you know, they weren't really spending a lot of money. So even what the aircraft they had left were fell into disrepair and now are currently grounded just because they haven't been maintained that they aren't safe enough for pilots to be in. So they currently don't even really have the capability to defend their own national airspace. It's kind of a matter of national pride. Every country wants to be able to defend their airspace.
Well, of course.
And so they might be looking for a few, you know, could pick up a couple jets that they could be able to do that with.
One more that I'm really curious about is Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico is really interesting that they really only have 10 fighter jets right now. These are these old F-5s. So they're American jets.
Yeah.
Now, if you think about it, you can kind of understand that, you know, the United States is the north, so they kind of protect their airspace, and you know, the United States might not really be thrilled about these advanced fighter jets so close to its border. But really, I mean, these are old fighter jets that they might be looking to replace. So even if they buy 10 jets, we're looking at, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in potential.
10 jets or one F-35.
Yeah.
You could trade off. Duncan, what does this mean ultimately? Is this just the beginning?
Absolutely.
I mean, what's next? Ships?
Ships are a little bit unique because we don't actually build ships for other countries. We often retire our ships and then give them to
other
countries.
And then give them away or sink them for reefs.
The next analysis that we're going to do is kind of heavy armor. So if you can think about tanks or APCs or armored personnel carriers that every country has needs. And you know, we have a whole manufacturing capability of these and something that's easy to export.
Do we train them as well?
We do.
Really? Don't just give them the keys. That's good to know. Good to know. His name is Duncan Amos, and thank you so much for being a part of the program.
Thank you.
This is Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And who remembers the severe acute respiratory syndrome? Anyone? All right, maybe not the full name, but I'm sure you remember SARS. Yes, that little virus that killed like 774 people around 2002, 2003. Well, SARS is out of here, but sound the alarm again because MERS is approaching us. It's the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome or coronavirus. Officials don't fully understand it. Globally, we're not prepared for it. Here with more on the subject is Bloomberg Government Quantitative Analyst Nicholas Riscassi. Nick, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, seriously? Another virus?
Another one. Another two, actually.
Two, right. The coronavirus as well. So
H7N9.
It just baffles me that they come up with these things, the names and numbers and the whole deal. I understand. It's a chemical kind of thing. But the analysis is called New Pandemic Threat Poses Risks and Opportunities. I understand the risks. Tell me a little bit more about the opportunities.
Okay, so the opportunities are really tied more to contracting. So we saw with SARS and also with H5N1, which was the avian flu, and H1N1, which was the swine flu, that there were a lot of other companies and vaccine producers, that kind of had a lot of different contract opportunities totaling over, you know, $1.5 billion, whether it involved vaccine production, vaccine transportation, vaccine disposal, the creation of new facilities, the supplying of TSA with masks, or supplying of facilities with sort of new services and stuff that are somehow involved with vaccine production, that contractors really stand to gain a lot because the HHS has a vaccine stockpile. So when anything new comes out, I mean, they do this sort of every year with the new influenza strain that they prepare for, they create a decent enough vaccines in theory to prevent an outbreak in the U.S. So we're going to see the same sort of thing with MERS and also with H7N9.
So the good news, if there is any, in this analysis that you've given us here, is that the influenza is on the decline.
Correct. It is on the decline, and this is either, they're not entirely sure if this is due to containment measures or just kind of a seasonal flux, but the issue with the influenza virus is that it's kind of something, as everybody knows, there's, you know, an influenza season every year. It's something that's continually evolving, so it's declining, but it's, you know, it's not something that's going to be completely out of the world stage.
Give me an idea of what the Department of Agriculture plans on doing to help us out with this, if the outbreak does, I don't know, I guess to prevent the outbreak from fully hitting our stores, because this is actually transmittable to from human to livestock.
Correct.
That's great.
So
that's great. That's just great.
So the Department of Agriculture actually has, dealing specifically with H7N9, which would be the avian flu, they monitor all of the sort of chicken stocks, as it were, and in order to be able to detect any sort of virus strain that's found within there. And also, I think currently there's a ban on live imports as well as hatching eggs from China and I believe 45 other countries where there's sort of a risk of importing birds that are infected.
You know, I went to school out in Salisbury, Maryland. I went to Salisbury State, and there's a, well, Purdue has a farm out there. There's chickens all over the place. Why would we, do we import many live chickens?
Apparently, yeah.
Really?
A decent amount, yeah.
I'm so used to seeing those things pepper in Route 50, it's not even funny. And you're telling me that we're bringing them in alive?
Yeah.
And well, okay.
Not as many right now.
Apparently not. Apparently not. So the viruses, the vaccines that they have at this point, nothing fully developed. I mean, this really was identified in 2012, is what
yes.
they're saying. And it's kind of taken hold, and are they trying to get ahead of this, or is this more of a knee-jerk reaction to, oh my gosh, pending doom, pandemic, we all need to hide and run for the hills?
So it seems like it's more of a combination, because one of the things that they found with SARS...
That doesn't make me feel better,
no.
Nick.
So they're certainly trying to get ahead of it, and they've certainly, since SARS and the other H1 and H5, they've started putting in place different technologies for vaccine development, and they have tried to step up the sort of the U.S. preparation for a possible outbreak. But the issue with MERS, which was also an issue with SARS, is that there isn't really any sort of effective vaccine that can be used to treat humans. I think the one that they had tested for SARS a few years ago had found to cause like other stomach problems in rats when they tested it as well. So it's one of those things
we
where they're trying to get ahead
with
of it.
Stomach problems. That's,
exactly.
That's
yeah. Which is what we're really trying to prevent.
Right.
So it was one of those things where I think they are trying to get ahead of it, but I think the technology is such that
right.
it's very difficult to do so when, you know, you were 10 years out from the SARS issue, and we still don't have a usable vaccine for that.
I can honestly tell you, I don't ever remember seeing people walking around with medical masks on their faces 24 hours a day until the SARS outbreak. I envision that happening here again very soon, because we're hitting a busy time of year.
Yeah.
People are going to start traveling.
Yeah.
They're going to start heading over. This is a Middle Eastern disease. We've got a major holiday
yeah.
coming up over there.
For July.
Yeah, in the month of July. Ramadan is coming, and I would imagine there are going to be a lot of people traveling. This is going to pose a big problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Big health risk. I mean, fasting is part
yes.
of this holiday.
Yes, which poses a bit of a risk to the immune system as
exactly.
well.
Exactly.
And close contact with lots of people, which...
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So...
That's awesome. I am going to dig a hole and live in that from now on. So, Nick, it's been great This is, you know, I sent this to my wife, who is a pediatric nurse at Children's Hospital. And she said, her text to me after she read it was, "That's a great story. It's also really scary." So be afraid. Be very, very afraid. What should we look out for next, if anything? Do we need to prepare ourselves?
I would say that other than taking sort of health precautions, it's kind of up in the air as far as whether or not there's a chance that it won't hit. H7N9, as I said, looks to be dying down. It could spring back up again, and hopefully MERS will stay outside of the U.S.
So, I don't see that happening.
Keep your fingers crossed.
I don't see that happening. Everybody, go get the bread, milk, and toilet paper now. We're in for a bumpy ride this summer. The analysis is called New Pandemic, Threats Pose Risk and Opportunities. It's a BGov Insight. His name is Nicholas Riscasi. He's a quantitative analyst with Bloomberg Government. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact, and she's back. Yes, our favorite economic analyst, Dr. Neela Richardson, senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government, is here. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me again.
Glad to have you, as usual. You know, we talked at the beginning of the program about some of the things that you'll be bringing up. First, of course, let's talk jobs. Let's talk job numbers. But they may have been overshadowed by a different event. Am I accurate in that assessment?
You know, you're very accurate. The market was very pleased with the latest jobs report, which said that the jobs increased by 175,000 in the month of May. But that euphoria was eclipsed by Ben Bernanke's press conference. That's the Federal Reserve Chairman, when he said that the Fed may take their foot off the gas and slow down asset purchases, slow down the rate of stimulus. That sent the market into a tailspin.
Right.
Very worried that the Fed would stop boosting up the economy and keeping rates very low.
Ultimately, the market ended up not too far off from where it began the day of his announcement, but tumbling hundreds of points as the day progressed. People just knee-jerking, like, whoa, this is going to be bad. I better get out now while I can.
Right. And so we have to remember that there is a distinction between a market response and an economic response, because at the end of the day, we need the economy to create jobs to grow,
right,
not just to raise stock prices. And so we have to make sure that the kind of jobs that the economy is producing are those jobs that lead to economic growth and consumer spending. And this jobs report actually shed doubt on that particular fact.
How much of that, again, I always bring this up, me being the naysayer, how much of that is people who have fallen out of the system, who have just given up?
So we saw that the rate of unemployment increased a bit. That could have been because people were hopeful and came back into the jobs market looking for jobs. But what we also saw, which I consider a very disturbing trend, is that the economy was creating a lot of part-time jobs. So the sectors that really took off are the sectors that are known for having pretty crummy jobs, like the retail sector.
Right.
And so what we're seeing is perhaps that people are trading off a desired full-time employment for taking whatever they can get, which is usually part-time.
I know of people who have lost their jobs as a result of sequestration. One person in particular, still unemployed. It's been about 5 months.
Mm-hmm. And so the long-term unemployed, those who have been unemployed 27 weeks or more, they're about a third of the 12 million or so Americans that are unemployed now. And that is a very persistent iceberg that hasn't melted yet, the number of long-term unemployed.
You have to feel for those people, especially coming on the heels of an announcement earlier this week about the amount of cash reserves the typical American has on hand. Mm-hmm. And most people don't have enough to sustain themselves more. A lot of people are living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And you know, what used to build wealth for the middle class in the country is the housing market, the house. The house was the savings account that you could build equity over time. And that role in the economy has been disrupted by the subprime crisis and the lack of credit that prevents new home buyers and young home buyers from acquiring homes now.
Yeah, less of passing along a blood sample and you know, DNA to produce a child outside of the marriage. It's going to be virtually impossible for people. Although we are starting to see somewhat of a turnaround now.
So we got some good numbers today.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Please.
So home sales were higher than anticipated existing home sales. So that was a great sign for the market. We also saw some growth in house prices with the case Case-Shiller price index. And so what we're seeing now is a housing market that's recovering. But you know, and your mom, the realtor, the real estate expert can tell you that, you know, real estate is local. It's location, location, location. So in some parts of the country, like Washington, D.C., we're seeing a housing market that is heating up quite a bit. But in other parts, we're still seeing that backload of foreclosures and distressed home sales. We really have a very differentiated housing market across the country, with some house prices going through the roof in a lot of cities and stagnating other places.
So that's good to hear. Obviously, knowing that house prices in our area at least are starting to stabilize and people are actually gaining equity, so to speak. And those who have been unfortunate enough to be out of work have a recourse. As I drive around, I see signs everywhere. 3% rate, 2%, 2.5 with qualifying, blah, blah, blah. How are rates faring at this point? Will they stay where they are?
Well, rates are historically low. I mean, if you look about what rates were in the 1980s, mm-hmm. there's just no comparison. Oh, we were talking double-digit mortgage rates.
Everything was assumable back then. Right. You know?
And now definitely less than 4%, maybe less than 3.5%. But rates did have risen somewhat from their rock bottom lows, mm-hmm. Mainly on fear that the Fed again would stop the stimulus, stop the asset purchasing program. What I think is what you'll see is that rates may hover, they may go up and down, but they're still going to stay under 5%, which is an extremely affordable rate.
Yeah, affordable.
There is some concern, though, if they were to top 5%, then you would see a slowdown in the housing market. So we'll see. That doesn't bear out historically, but credit is so tight now. Who knows if any kind of friction in this market could reduce housing activity a bit?
Well, I would imagine, I did a lot of driving over the weekend all the way down to Leonardtown, Maryland, and came back and saw lots of new home construction. So mm-hmm. the builders are out there building them. I would assume that they're going to make sure that people can get into them. So maybe we're seeing a relaxing of the rules somewhat.
Right, and we're seeing some builder confidence. It's mm-hmm. improving. So we're right at the tip of that summer buying season. This summer could determine whether housing is completely out of the woods or not. So this is a great summer to have that kind of signpost. But there's something else that's on the horizon that I think a lot of people in the housing market are going to be paying attention to, and that is the reform of housing mortgage giants Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. We have some new bills that may be introduced very soon that spell out a reform plan for the GSEs and a new overhaul of the housing finance market. Right. So it's a question mark and a very big one on what effect that will have on housing markets as well.
And I'm sure you will be back to answer that question when that answer is given.
I hope to be. Thank you.
Her name is Dr. Neela Richardson, Senior Economic Analyst with Bloomberg Government. Thanks again for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And with that, we put the wraps on yet another edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at BGov. Follow me on Twitter at Alan L. Scott as well. I'd love to hear what you have to say. Maybe show topics. We'll start a little conversation, shall we? Tweet away at Alan L. Scott. Did you know Bloomberg Government has a television program? It's called Capital Gains, seen weekly, Sundays at 11:30, immediately following Face the Nation. Hosted by Bloomberg Television's Peter Cook. Good program, all about the business impact of government actions on TV. Sundays at 11:30, immediately following Face the Nation. Hosted by Peter Cook. It's Capital Gains. We'll catch you next Thursday at 11 with more of the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.